Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you woofle, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I've heard orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon, and a thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest homeland, comrades. It's July the 31st, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Let's see, what should we kick off with this week? Tell you what. For several weeks now, we've been running a segment of the show comparing how well genuine federal law enforcement out here in the real world stacks up against the Hollywood image of steely-eyed FBI guys and gals tracking down wicked, evil serial killers and Al-Qaeda sleeper cells and various James Bond weirdo villain types who want to smuggle nuclear bombs into the U.S. and, of course, us wicked white supremacists as well. You know, the usual bogus boogeymen that the dictatorship uses to frighten Americans to death and beg for protection from thugs in black body armor to make them feel safe. Now, the fact that there has not been one provable act of deliberate organized Muslim terrorism in this country since 9/11, and yes, I know that there are problems with 9/11 as well, please don't send me all kinds of emails about that, but like I say, there has not been one provable act of deliberate organized Muslim terrorism in this country since September 11th, 2001, put it that way, with the possible exception of the Boston Marathon bombing. Now, the fact that serial killers are very overrated and are usually caught by local law enforcement, not the mighty FBI out of Quantico. The fact that most so-called white nationalists live in an online fantasy world and would never dream of lifting a finger against our lords and masters or any of their black and brown pets. These facts always just disappear when the Hollywood scriptwriters come on the scene. Now, I've had several requests to do a feature on the murder of Vicky Weaver by an FBI agent named Lon Horiuchi and what happened at Ruby Ridge, but I'm going to pass on that for a while I sit down and really figure out how to approach it, because Ruby Ridge was an extremely important milestone in our movement's history, and it probably shouldn't be taken on in my usual light-hearted, half-sarcastic manner. Anyway, this week, I figure we'll begin with another episode of Quis Custodiet Ipsos Custodes, Who Guards the Guardians? Now, you know how on these TV shows and movies like Criminal Minds and 24, the big bad FBI has these women, usually pretty good looking, sitting behind computers back at the office in some high-tech cubicle type surroundings, and the FBI agents can just flip open their cell phones and ask Penelope or Chloe or Abby to hack into any database, break into any supposedly confidential record, track down how many kids with freckles graduated from some elementary school in Arkansas in 1991, that kind of thing. And you know, these forensic-oriented shows like CSI and Bones and the British show Waking the Dead, where they have these big, huge, well-equipped crime labs staffed with Nobel laureate scientists with every latest piece of super-tech equipment under the sun for analyzing any substance or artifact known to man. Now, have you noticed how almost all of these brilliant forensic scientists also happen to be women or non-whites of some kind? Now, apparently, to watch these television shows and these movies, us dumbass white boys really aren't very good at science. And if you see how these fantastic nigger gook and female scientists can reconstruct a crime from a single carpet fiber or a piece of glass and tell the steely-eyed feds how it all went down, Now, I think that at least part of this is deliberate on Hollywood's part. The message they're trying to convey, subliminally and not so subliminally, is that resistance is futile, that any of us pale peons who even so much as think of breaking the rules will be immediately and inevitably tracked down, not only by the steely-eyed guys and gals in their black flak jackets and their badges and waving their black plastic guns in the air, but by the entire force of modern science, infallible, inexorable. And so none of us pale little boys had better even so much as think of breaking a rule or being disrespectful in any way. In reality, of course, actually, breaking the rules is quite easy and reasonably safe once someone loses their fear and breaks brave. Time and again in Iraq, Afghanistan, and among the gangbangers in L.A. and Chicago, all over this country, events have proven that lightly armed militias or gangs, without fear of the Americans who don't care about their own personal safety too much, can defeat their high technology. They won't do it without some bloodshed on their side, but the United States of America is not invincible. American technology is not invincible. Anyway, how does all this shake out in real life compared to the Hollywood version? Step forward, all you brilliant boy and girl squints from the FBI crime lab. Come on down.
There's a man who leads a life of danger. Everyone he meets, he stays a stranger. Read every move he makes. Another chance he takes. Odds are he won't live to see tomorrow. Secret Asian man, secret Asian man. They've given you a number and taken away your name.
The FBI Laboratory is a division within the FBI that provides forensic analysis and other technical services to the Bureau, and also to state and local law enforcement agencies. Now, the lab is currently located in the famous FBI facility at Quantico, Virginia, where such luminaries as Robert Hansen's prostitute friend, Margot Bennett's lesbian lover, and numerous school groups have received guided tours. Today, the lab also contains various electronic and computer sections. Now, because of the growing use of electronic and computer surveillance by the Bureau, almost half of the 1,000 or so employees of the lab are employed along that line, although they also stash a lot of those electronic eavesdroppers in other departments and use other budgets for them. Now, for many years, the FBI lab enjoyed the reputation as the premier crime lab in the world. But during the 1990s, under the Clinton regime, its reputation and integrity began to unravel. Now, this was primarily due to the efforts of a man named Special Agent Dr. Frederick Whitehurst, who is probably the most famous whistleblower in the history of the Bureau. Now, Whitehurst joined the FBI in 1982, and he served as a supervisory special agent at the lab from 1986 until 1998. That was 12 years, where he got a first-hand look at some of the crap that was going on in there. Now, he was the first to blow the lid off the lab. He cited outdated equipment, outdated scientific technique, and also what he referred to as a quote-unquote pro-prosecution bias of the lab technicians, who were FBI agents first and forensic scientists second, due to the quote-unquote institutional culture of the Bureau, which is a polite way of saying that the FBI are not law enforcement agents or proper detectives. They are political secret police, and their job is to torture, imprison, and kill anyone their paymasters tell them to, and that goes for the lab geeks as well as the field agents. Whitehurst was able to trigger a congressional investigation wherein it was found that evidence had been tampered with, misanalyzed, incompetently and incorrectly handled, and in some cases deliberately falsified, altered, or suppressed. This investigation found that FBI agents had testified falsely in as many as 10,000 cases, resulting in many false convictions. Now, to this day, cases are still being overturned because of this massive fraud committed by hundreds of FBI agents working in the crime lab. Now, the latest scandal is that there are a lot of innocent people out there who still don't know they're innocent because the Justice Department, after all this, refuses to notify the defendants who were sitting in prison or their attorneys that there was a question on the forensics work on their case. It's kind of left up to the defense attorneys and the defendants themselves to just sort of acquire this knowledge by mental telepathy or something. The FBI and the Justice Department have stated that they are not required by law to notify someone when, through their own efforts, that person has been falsely convicted. And apparently that's the way the law reads. Do I need even to tell you that not one agent has been punished for this? Not one agent has been punished for lying under oath to send innocent people to prison? Not even reassigned to Anchorage, Alaska? Never mind arrested and put in the same filthy prisons where they sent so many other people? Of course I don't need to tell you that. That's a given. In 1998, John F. Kelly and Philip K. Wern published a book called Tainting the Evidence, Inside the Scandals at the FBI Crime Lab. Now, it seems that another problem with the FBI crime lab was simple human arrogance. Lab employees had been told for so long that they were the best forensic experts in the world that they came to believe it. And by the way, that applies to these stupid TV shows I mentioned on here as well. When you have an entire industry telling you how great you are and displaying images of these fictional characters like Jack Bauer and Aaron Hotchner like they were real, if you're carrying a federal badge, eventually you're going to start believing your own propaganda, which is always a mistake. You're going to start thinking that you really are bee's knees and that you really do have the right to just kick in doors and destroy people's lives for the crime of talking bad about Barry and Michelle, or for objecting to having a big federal truck come up and dump 200 illegal immigrants on your front lawn, as is happening now in some places. According to several sympathetic investigations conducted by the Justice Department down through the years, and I might add that the Justice Department always has to be dragged kicking and screaming to investigate all this stuff when something happens and the scandal just gets too stinky. Anyway, FBI lab employees, according to these investigations, failed to keep abreast of developments in forensic science. They mishandled evidence, mislabeled evidence, lost evidence, destroyed evidence while playing around with their chemistry sets in the lab, lied under oath, blah, 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 blah. Now, the worst problem was that the lab employees were FBI agents rather than pure forensic scientists, and I quote, "The investigative paradigm of the detective is antithetical to the investigative paradigm of the scientist," unquote. FBI lab employees work backwards from conclusions that are preordained by the prosecutors they serve. They seek to justify that conclusion rather than using more scientific research paradigms. In other words, the FBI lab regularly violates Sherlock Holmes's basic principle. Never twist the facts to fit your theories. Change your theories to fit the facts. Now, put more simply, in an ideal world, the Bureau would be a law enforcement agency. They would wait until there was actually some evidence that someone has committed a crime before opening a case file, or wiretapping them, or surveilling them, or harassing them, or maybe kidnapping and torturing and murdering them because someone up in the pecking order told them to do so. But it's not like that in the real world. Now, the scandals kept coming. I'm being careful to quote only good liberal Democrat sources here, so let's go to the Huffington Post. For the last year, and by the way, in this article, the year is 2012, the FBI Crime Lab Agency has been embroiled in yet another huge and growing scandal in which crime lab technicians have been found to have, and I quote, "vastly overstated the value and conclusiveness of forensic evidence in criminal cases. The breadth and the seriousness of the problem have only come to light in the last year or so, although there have been warning signs going back to the 1990s. Yeah, that's what they call the Whitehurst investigation, a warning sign. The number of convictions affected by this latest round of incompetence and lying on the part of agents of the Federal Bureau of Investigation is in the thousands, possibly the tens of thousands. One of them is the case of a man named Edgar Steele. Another is the case of a man named Bill White. Now, in July 2012, the Justice Department announced a nationwide review of all cases handled by the FBI Laboratories Hair and Fibers Unit before 2000. That's at least 21,000 cases. In order to determine whether improper lab reports or testimony might have contributed to a wrongful conviction. Oh, no, that can't be. About 36 FBI agents have trained between 600 to 1,000 state and local examiners to apply the same standards and use the same techniques that have proven problematic in federal cases. None of the local cases was included in this federal review back in 2012. Now, the number of flawed cases at the state and local levels could be even higher. The Hufflepuff concluded that basically, for the last 40 years, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has been presenting evidence in federal courtrooms to judges and juries that is basically crap and utterly useless or else downright fabricated in order to obtain convictions of people that someone within the dictatorship wanted convicted, for whatever reason. All right, the Justice Department have known about this for years, and yet they have repeatedly failed to notify defendants or their attorneys in many cases where multiple investigations reveal bad science, incompetence, outright evidence tampering by FBI agents, and especially in cases involving hair and fiber evidence and DNA, which is nowadays often the only way the defendant is connected to the scene of the crime. They failed to notify the defendants or their attorneys. There are men sitting in prison right now who were actually more or less proven innocent years ago, and nobody's bothered to tell them about it because the FBI wants to cover its ass. So, why is this happening? Are all the FBI crime laboratory agents in the bag for the dictatorship, and do they just produce whatever forensic evidence is required of them on demand? Probably not. In a group of 1,000 people, it would be pretty strange if every single one of them were corrupt and amoral, although the Democratic Party comes pretty close. My guess, never having gotten the Quantico tour that assorted prostitutes, lesbians, Russian spies, and mob moles have gotten, my guess is that a lot of it is simply incompetence due to affirmative action or diversity. Or so they can have an FBI crime lab that looks like America or whatever moronic phrase the Bureau uses these days to put useless niggers and unqualified women on the federal payroll. Now, my guess is that there is a small handful of quote-unquote reliable techs and scientists in the FBI crime lab that the big boys go to when they most deaf want a specific result. Now, most likely all of those are white males, totally corrupt, who can be trusted with delicate jobs like fabricating audio files, wherein Edgar Steele supposedly hires a hitman, that kind of thing. I think there are many more techs and analysts and assorted lab coat geeks who are there not because they have any particular skills or because they're any good at what they ostensibly do, but because they have dark skins or tits on them. And I think a lot of these people are just plain stupid, and they make stupid mistakes, and then they lie to cover it up. Somebody said, when they were talking about our little movement, that if you're given a choice between conspiracy or incompetence when dealing with anything to do with the federal government, pick incompetence every time. Now, the one exception to that is you often will find conspiracy to cover up the incompetence. Now, hiring or promoting someone, anyone, into any job based on any consideration other than qualifications, skills, and merit is moronic. Our lords and masters either don't know this or they don't care, and if they're stupid, incompetent affirmative action lab techs and forensic analysts in the FBI crime lab send thousands of innocent people to prison, as it looks like they have done, the FBI simply doesn't care. It's what they do, after all. The FBI is an inhuman machine that requires human lives, human blood and bone, and human suffering to fuel it in order to keep those federal dollars flowing. Every year, hundreds of thousands of people of all races are pulled into the mangling machine that is Obama's America, and the FBI will do its part to make sure that terrible engine of damnation which this country has become will never run out of fuel.
Secret.
Every week, people send me suggestions and requests for songs that they want me to play on this show. A lot of times, they will actually send me an MP3 file of a song that they want played on the show. And about half the time, in my senility and my rush to get something done while I'm slinging E, as I call it, behind my computer here, I forget to make a notation as to who sent in the song. And that has happened in this case. This is called Cantus Primus. It's a fairly nice, lilac-sounding, new-agey type thing. Haven't played anything like that on here for a while. Some new-age music is all right. And I would just like to once again apologize to the person who sent this in for failing to make a note of your name, and so I can't dedicate the song to you. Anyway, here it is.
Comrades, tonight I'm going to discuss a classic work, Imperium by Francis Parker Yockey, Now, as I was saying last week, Yaki believed that every culture goes through stages, and the last stage would be the Imperium stage. And the stage prior to Imperium for our culture was a stage dominated by England, and this was dominated by rationalism. This leads to Darwinism, Freudianism, and Marxism. Now, Yaki sees all of these viewpoints as materialistic and therefore overly reductionist. To be honest, I think he somewhat has an unclear view with regard to Darwinism, but I think he deliberately dislikes all of these viewpoints. He believes that the West is now going into a stage where it will be dominated, or at least should be dominated, by ethnical socialism. And he talks about this as a Prussian concept. Now, he says that the age of 19th century nationalism, which was a reaction against Napoleon, is something that is really finished in modern times, and that now this notion of nationalism has really been redefined. And now it's really a pro-Western viewpoint. Now, I say pro-Western instead of pro-white specifically because Yaki was an assimilationist, so he's not any stickler for purity. Now, as far as this idea of assimilation, he talks a lot about Slavic peoples, and he says that because they're actually a part of the founding northern stock, they can actually be assimilated rather easily, but within their own culture, they remain barbarian. And that as such, they're driven by instinct rather than intellect. And because of this viewpoint, he also sees Russia as being a part of the Asiatic sphere of influence. And he says that really Russia did very well in terms of the Second World War because they were the only group that really won both politically and militarily. Although he also seems to be of the opinion that Japan came out of the war in some respects better off because of increased westernization. He talks about America as, of course, starting out as a colony. And because it was a colony, it really had no politics in the sense that Europe would have politics. Because it really never dealt with a roughly equal foe. Anyone that wanted to go out and explore or conquer new parts of America would just go out and they would only confront a fairly primitive Indian culture. He says that one of the few times that Americans did have politics was during the War of Secession. And that was a war in which the quality of the South was overcome by the quantity of the North. Now, as a fairly aristocratic individual, of course, Yaki is unhappy about that, and he's also very unhappy about the American goal of a happy life. But he's hopeful that Americans will one day rebel against their government, and he believes this rebellion can spiritually reunite America with Europe. Now, he has this rather strange conclusion in this book. He's writing this book in 1948, and he seems to have this view that Western nations ideally should invade Russia for the sake of Lebensraum, for the sake of bases where they can farm, because he's very worried about food shortages in 1948 that were taking place in Europe because of the really vengeful nature of allies in 1948. Because of this rather extreme conclusion, I can well imagine why Mosley, after having been in prison, or for that matter, Rockwell or Colin Jordan and other people in that circle would want to distance themselves from this treatise. And I could understand that because, really, this idea of going to war against a white nation seems fairly ridiculous in 1948. So, as far as Yaki being really pro-Soviet or pro-Russian or pro-Slavic, I really don't see where any of that is applicable to Yaki. I would say quite the opposite. Although, of course, he does see these elements as possible elements for assimilation into the West. Now, one element he definitely sees as unassimilatable would be the Negroes, because he really says those groups are really too different to become assimilated into the West at all. Now, he does talk about the Jews as having a parasitic culture and how they have been involved in cultural distortion within the West, and how the West did not realize this because the West was used to dealing with nationalities that had armies and territories. And because the Jews came from an Arabic culture where there really wasn't a lot of space and there were peoples that did not have armies and territories, Westerners did not really see the Jews as being a cultural block. However, again, Yaki is an assimilationist, and he seems to believe that individual Jews can potentially assimilate into Western culture, and this was likely another sore spot between Yaki and, for example, someone like Rockwell. Now, this is a very impressive treatise, both in terms of the depth of knowledge and the breadth of knowledge. And so I can understand that regardless of its eccentricities, I can see where it stood the time. And therefore, I could easily recommend it because there are a lot of insights, particularly, I think, in terms of the notion of personal austerity in life that he seems to champion. Now, this book is available for a very nominal fee if you want to get it on Kindle. I would have to say it isn't necessarily a quick read. It's something to really ponder. Now, I should also say that he makes the point that the effect of World War I and also World War II was that, and the real winners of these wars at the end of the day were the colored peoples of the earth, because they saw at the end of the day weaknesses within the West that they would be ready to pounce on. The way that Yaki ranks different races is that he ranks them according to their will to power. And Yaki's definition of race is not really a scientific definition. It's more this notion that someone who possesses race is someone who is unwilling to remain in slavery and is true to themselves. And as such, someone with these qualities, almost regardless of background, unless they were, say, a Negro, could be potentially assimilated in his mind, and that's why he has this assimilationist view. But as much as a liberal assimilationist as he is, he does worry about Europe being overrun by various immigrants beyond what it could assimilate. And he says if that happens, Europeans may have to be just fighting for territory instead of fighting for an imperium. So I hope you enjoyed this review. There's a lot of concepts in this book, but I really need to wrap this up because it's running rather long. So if you haven't taken the time to read this book already, I hope you do so. And thank you very much for listening, and hail victory, comrades.
As with many Radio Free Northwests, this show's going to be a little bit lopsided. I'm going to go right to second music break right now, because the third section is going to be really long. Now, when I was living in Ireland, I learned that southern Appalachian hillbillies aren't the world's only moonshiners. In Ireland, they make a form of moonshine called poitin, P-O-I-T-I-N, and I had some of it when I was over there. It's pretty raw. Like all moonshine, it gets sold under the counter and whatnot, and sold after hours so the drunks can keep on drinking, so forth and so on. A real proper traditional Irish moonshiner out on the west coast someplace will use grain of some sort to make his hooch with, but the cheaper and more commercial ones will use potatoes. The result is almost a kind of a vodka. Anyway, this is an Irish moonshining song. This is Hair of the Dog.
In the old tin can, the mash, the colour, my body and the run. Run like the devil from the excise man, because what wouldn't rise in Barney? Keep your eyes and feel the day, the excise man, they're on their way. Switching o'er the mountain, take the hills of Canavara. Gather up the pots in the old tin can, the mash, the colour, my body and the run. Run like the devil from the excise man, because what wouldn't rise in Barney?
Mountain breezes twist and blow, hear them echo in the glen below. The guppy men are on the go in the hills of Connemara.
Gather up the pots in the old tin can, the mash, car in the body of the van. Run like the devil from the excise van, because what wouldn't rise in Barney?
The butcher cut the tongue, but a foot pulled by the drum. Help his spears and limbs along in the hills of Canmara.
Gather up the pots in the old tin can, a mash, the car in the body of the van. Run like the devil from the excise van, because what the rise in Barney?
Stand your ground, boys, it's too late. The excise man is not at the gate. Tomorrow you'll get out of our wicked and slay the hills of Canmara.
Gather up the pots in the old tin can, a mash, the car in the body of the van. Run like the devil from the excise van, because what the rise in Barney? Swing to the left and swing to the right, the excise man will dance all night. Drinking up the tea in the broad daylight in the hills of Canavara. Gather up the pots in the old tin can, the mash, the corn, the barley and the bread. Run like the devil from the excise man, because what the rise in Barney?
Well, good morning and welcome. This is Mike Harris on Revolution Radio, and today is Thursday, July 24th, 2014. And as promised, my guest for today is author and really social architect, Harold Covington. Welcome to the show, Harold. How are you, sir?
Oh, pretty good. Now, can you hear me?
I can hear you just fine. Sound great.
Okay, right. Okay, I'm on then.
Loud and clear. And I like the new title I gave you of social architect, because you're one of the few guys out there who's really put together a plan for something that can work. You haven't been on in a couple of weeks, months actually, but one of the things I've been talking about lately is that our government was hijacked when we had the Kennedy assassination, the murder of JFK, and really a coup took place where evil elements, part of the military-industrial complex, Lyndon Johnson, Jewish elements, etc., came in and really hijacked the country from its duly elected process. You know, since that time, you've been on a steady downward spiral. You look at the very next year. Well, JFK was killed in November of 1963. LBJ couldn't get sworn in fast enough because he was going to be indicted if he didn't hold the office of president. So he had to get himself sworn in to protect himself so he could call off all the law enforcement that was going to bring him down. 65, you know, we had the Civil Rights Act, we had Immigration Reform Act, we had the War on Poverty. We had all of these counterproductive programs that have not done anything to help America. And since then, it's grown. You know, we had the 1970, we had the War on Drugs. 1996, 97, we got into NAFTA, we got into CAFTA, we got into GATT, let China the WTO, gave China most favored nation status. Now we have Obamacare. We have all of these, what I will call failed policies. And nobody in Washington wants to say, hey, these policies did not hit their stated goals. They missed. We have more poverty than ever, so the war on poverty is a failure. We have more drugs than ever, the war on drugs is a failure. Illegal immigration is out of control, so the Immigration Reform Act of 65 was a failure. Nobody wants to call these things the failures that they are. And so one of my points is that if my computer gets infected, I've got a known good date that I can reset my computer to. I can go back and say, all right, it wasn't infected then. It worked really great. Let's wipe everything out that's happened, and let's go to this known good restore point, what they call it.
Yeah, take it back to a previous version.
Yeah, to a previous version. And I look at this in this country today and say, you know, let's take this country back to a previous version where we know it worked. Let's take it back to November 1st, 1963, and put everything back in place the way it was then, before they murdered Kennedy, before that coup occurred. Mm-hmm. Just wanted to get your feelings on it. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think everybody in our community, our movement, whatever you want to call it, has their own idea as to when exactly the country started down the wrong path. Some would say the Kennedy assassination. Some would say the election of Franklin Roosevelt in 1933. I myself tend to pinpoint it as 1913 when the Federal Reserve was instituted, but there's no doubt that things would have been different had Kennedy remained in office, and I am just old enough to remember Uncle Cornball, as they used to call LBJ. I mean, I can remember he was no prize.
Well, he was ready to be indicted by the Senate for his own malfeasance. You know, he was really a crook. I mean,
oh, yeah.
He was a bold-faced crook. Sam Rayburn was going to indict him.
Well, he was the ultimate Texas politician. Mayor Daley had nothing on LBJ as far as raising the dead from their graves to vote for Democrat, vote for LBJ. I think actually there have been a number of events in American history which, when you look at their immediate and historical effects, constitute quiet, sometimes not so quiet, coup d'etats. I think that we are undergoing one right now when Barack Obama has essentially abolished the United States border by ceasing to enforce immigration laws and putting Border Patrol agents on, you know, diaper-changing detail. There are now at least 300,000 so-called children who have come into the country since January. I mean, we knew this was going to happen because back in January, the federal government was advertising for transport for these kids. They are not being detained anywhere on the border. They are being bused in huge groups all over the country in order to basically break up Republican voting areas. And I believe that this, in essence, constitutes a coup d'etat. It is an attempt by Obama and the people who are controlling Obama in the Democrat Party and in the power elite to, in essence, overthrow the constitutional government of the United States. And as I'm sure they expected, normal people, white people, are responding with a few agonized squeals and tapping on computer keyboards. So the result is that this coup will probably succeed. None of these so-called children or dreamers or whatever they're called are going to be sent back, ever. And in effect, the demographic change in the United States, which, you know, paranoid right-wing nuts like you and me have been warning about for decades now, is now occurring in a few months. That constitutes a coup right there.
Well, let me ask you this. First of all, you know, we've had a couple of things have happened. You know, whenever the Senate passed the NDAA, which really guts the Bill of Rights, it really destroys the Bill of Rights. There is no Bill of Rights. Yeah. And so we had that passed the Senate by a vote of
people. Yeah.
Yeah. That passed the Senate by a vote of 97-0. So we have 97 treasonous senators who are sitting in the Senate, living the good life, eating steak and eggs for breakfast every morning, caviar every night. But yet they should be hung by the neck for their crimes.
Yeah. See, what's happened, Mike, is they have finally understood that they can do whatever they want and nothing is going to be done about it. I just, before I signed on here, I was listening to the tag into Rush Limbaugh, and the House has now cleared a hurdle, quote-unquote, so that the House Republicans can sue President Obama. Well, whoop-dee-doo. It's just insane. I hate to sound like Eeyore, but they've won because they figured out that they can do anything they want and no one is going to actually, really, for real, do anything about it. Our forefathers gave us, in the Second Amendment of the United States Constitution, the means to deal with a government that has become tyrannical and out of control. We clearly are not going to make use of it, and so this is basically, at the risk of beating my own drum, there is now no hope for white people in this country or on this continent except for the Northwest migration. We are going to have to form local communities in the Pacific Northwest until we are strong enough to take back a part of our country and remove all of these destructive non-white elements, these bankers, these Democrats, these liberals, all the people that are causing the problems. They have to go, and we have to make our own country with our own government, our own courts, and our own armed forces. That is the only solution which is going to put a stop to what amounts to the genocide of white people in North America.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Why are they doing this? What is their end game? And that is to kill off all the white people.
Pretty much.
I want to point some things out, because you just mentioned the word genocide. Right now, there's a genocide going on as we speak. Actually, there's two of them going on as we speak. One of them is in Gaza, where the Palestinians are being genocided by the Israelis, actively being genocided. I mean, Hamas was formed by Israel to undermine Arafat and the PLO. Now they're going after Hamas, and Hamas is firing essentially bottle rockets while the Israelis are coming in with attacking Apache helicopters and AT-AT warthogs and just leveling whole neighborhoods. So there's a genocide going on there. The other genocide going on is in Ukraine, where the Jewish banker interest, you know, the chocolate king, Porky, Porkoshenko, who took over in the coup and crowned himself as president of Ukraine, is now threatening to exterminate all of the indigenous Ukrainians who live in eastern Ukraine who aren't going along with it. So we've got two active genocides. And I think there's a genocide coming to this country, but I want to point out who's behind the genocide. And that is Talmudic Jews are behind the genocides in both cases that we're seeing so far. And they're the same ones who are behind the genocide of Tsar Nicholas Romanov, his entire family, and 120 plus million innocent Christian Russians. And these are the same people, these dual Israeli citizens who constitute 50% of our current government, who want to bring this to a neighborhood near you and kill off white people and replace them with blacks and browns. So the question comes up next is, what are we going to do about it? Just sit around with our thumb up our keister?
Well, I'll tell you, Mike, first thing your listening audience needs to do is go to www.northwestfront.org. That's all one word, northwestfront.org, and we will show you what we're going to do about it. And I'm not just blowing my own horn here. The simple fact is the Northwest Front is the only group involved in white nationalism or in any kind of white resistance in this country that has an actual plan. The problem with our attempts at white resistance throughout this past 30, 40 years, well, there have been several problems. One of them has been a sense of drift. No one exactly knows what we're going to do about all this. This is why we rely so much on news commentary in all our literature. Basically, the movement consists of a bunch of sad old men sending each other newspaper clippings or now sending each other internet links and saying, oh, look what they're doing to us now. Isn't it just so horrible? Oh, won't somebody do something?
Well, Harold, somebody does something. I have to interject, because the theme of my show, as you heard coming in, has always been the Superman thing. And I tell people every day, there ain't no Superman. You got to get up off the sofa. You got to go do something. You got to go march in the street. You got to do something. I don't know what it is, but something. And work on this every single day, because it's coming to a neighborhood near you. You can't hide from it. It's going to find you. It's going to surround you. You're going to have no escape from it. So you might as well get up off the sofa and start working on it today and every day.
Exactly. People in my own circle of acquaintance, I have this impression that sometimes they're looking to me, waiting for me to pull the magic beans out of my pocket and throw them on the ground, and all of a sudden a mighty white revolutionary army is going to spring up from the earth. And I keep telling them, look, you are the magic beans, insofar as I have any. There is simply a limit to what one man can do. All white people are going to have to realize that we are in danger, physical, spiritual, financial, however you want to put it, and we have to act. The white people have this idea in the backs of their minds that when a revolution does come, it's going to be something they're going to sit and watch on television and maybe applaud. And then once the revolution is won, then everything's going to go back to the days of the Brady Bunch, and they can sit back down on the sofa, kick off their shoes, and turn on the TV remote. And it's just not going to be like that. The entire world is changing. The time of abundance, which we will remember from the 60s, 70s, even the 80s, that time is gone forever. You've got peak oil, which is going to make energy costs prohibitive. You have got the massive ethnic breakup of the North American continent, which is going to occur just as the Soviet Union went down. And you've got all of these factors converging, which are going to combine to make life for normal white people in the 21st century very, very rough indeed. We are going to have to change our whole outlook on life. We are going to have to change our thinking. And we are going to have to get out of the habit of being passive spectators to our own fate. Everybody is going to have to get involved. At some point in time, we are going to have to trigger a mass movement among white Americans before we are completely swamped and destroyed. This is the last white generation that's being born right now. If nothing is done, then our future reproduction rate alone will ensure that we are never able to recover anything of what our ancestors built, and that we are going to be destroyed as a people, as a culture, and as a civilization. It has to be done. It has to be done now. The clock has run out. Now, I say again, we have an idea which will work. It's like they say in Alcoholics Anonymous, it'll work if you work it. We understand that the country is going to break up, and the question is, what kind of a slice of the pie will the white man get? We say that the white man's slice of the American pie must be in the Pacific Northwest in the form of an independent, sovereign nation which will serve as a homeland for all white people the world over. See, right now, white people are persecuted not just here, but everywhere. New Zealand, Australia, Europe, Canada, wherever there are white people, we are under attack and under genocidal assault. There is no place for white people to run to. In my day, we thought we could run to South Africa and Rhodesia if it ever got too bad. Well, I went there, and I saw a lot of good there, but they didn't last. There has to be a homeland, some part of the earth, specifically set aside for white people only. And just like, maybe this is a bad comparison, but just like Israel is supposed to be the homeland of the Jews, the white man needs a homeland. Some place where there are only white people, where we can raise generations of new white children in spiritual, moral, and physical safety. So we have that plan. It is time to start implementing it because events are moving way out of our control. A year ago, I never would have expected that Obama would have simply said, okay, there is no border anymore. Come on, come on, come on. It's happening. The balloon is finally beginning to go up, and we are not ready.
Well, you're right about that. But let's dig a little bit deeper here. It's obvious to me that the Browns and the Blacks are being used as tools. They're not the impetus behind this. They're merely the pawns on the chessboard. Who is the chess master? Who's calling the shots? Where is this coming from?
The Jews and their allies. And I'm sorry to say that they do have Gentile allies who, out of self-interest or just plain depravity, do assist them in their... I wish I could sit here and tell you that the Jews were the whole problem and nothing but the fact is that there are a lot of the 1%, as the leftists call it, there are a lot of very wealthy white people, mostly men in suits, who have decided that profit means more than people, and who have decided that they are going to make money and increase their own power through the genocide of white people. I refer specifically to people involved in international banks, international finance, the stock market, the media, the professional intelligentsia, not just here but in Europe, government establishment and government bureaucracy. These people will do anything to preserve their own wealth and power, and if that includes trapping on their own people and sending their own people over the cliff into extinction, they will do it because they're completely immoral. They simply have no racial consciousness. They have no sense of morality. So there is a tiny elite of Jews and white people who voluntarily follow the Jewish agenda out of their own self-interest. They are very wealthy. They are in positions of power throughout the world. Now, I've never believed that once a year they have this big meeting and conspire, although the Bilderberg meetings would come close to that. But I think it's a conspiracy of consensus. The elite that rules the world today have decided that the white man is expendable, and some of them have decided that the white man is evil and wicked because we oppress everybody, blah, 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 and we must perish from the face of the earth. So,
Wait a minute. I have to challenge that statement because, you know, white people I know don't oppress anybody, never have, never will. Who I do see oppressing people is the people who you're talking about who want to eliminate the white race. That's this master race of Jewish supremacists and other people who want to wipe us up. And the reason I think that they do is because we're the only race that gives them any competition. We're the only ones who can actually do better than they do. We've always done better than they do, and that's kind of why they dislike us, I think.
Well, it's like in South Africa. The ANC government in South Africa, which contains a very high percentage of Jews, by the way, Jewish communists from the South African Communist Party, seemed to have enough rudimentary sense to realize that Kaffirs cannot run a modern technological society such as South Africa was under apartheid, and that if they simply kill off all the white people or run them out of the country like Mugabe did in Rhodesia, nothing's going to work. The electricity will fail, the agriculture will fail, they won't be able to feed themselves, the mines that produce their wealth will fail, and this is in essence what happened in Zimbabwe. Mugabe simply slaughtered all the whites, and now Zimbabwe is an absolute total basket case. And if nothing else, the multinational corporations, including Jewish-run corporations like the De Beers outfit, will not allow that to happen in South Africa because they know that they have to have technically skilled white people to run the infrastructure and the economy. So, in essence, what's happened in South Africa is the ANC Marxist government is keeping a few million tame white people as pets to run things, while they proceed to chip out and do their African thing, which consists mostly of lying around in their kraal, having babies with their Kaffir nannies and watching their cattle and their mealies grow, and dying of AIDS. So that, I think, is the game plan for America. What I can foresee, if nothing is done, in another 50 years, America will be one big seething non-white mass, similar to the movie Soylent Green, run by a very small Jewish and white elite, both financial, governmental, and technical, who actually keep some semblance of the infrastructure going. That is a hellish prospect that will not allow for the eventual survival of anything remotely resembling Western civilization, and eventually even that will be extinguished when that tiny elite at the top is finally simply overrun and snuffed out like a candle by the masses of black and brown savagery, at which point I think the Chinese will come in. You know, there was a time many thousands of years ago when Confucius said that it was written in the stars of destiny that all people of the world would one day be Chinese. He might turn out to be right. So what we're looking at in the next few hundred years, if nothing is done, is a period of non-white savagery, chaos, and collapse, followed by a massive Chinese invasion of some sort, wherein they will, in essence, take over, exterminate the blacks and the browns, except for some few that they keep as slaves, and then the world will be a great big Chinese anthill. I would rather that not happen. We have a plan to prevent it from happening, and I think everybody needs to get with that plan.
Well, you know, the Chinese model is not that attractive to most people. In fact, the Chinese don't even like it because that's why they're invading and taking over Vancouver. Now, I've made multiple trips to China. I ran a business out of Southeast Asia for close to 20 years. You know, I used to go over to Asia at least once a quarter. And whatever competition, when you look at China with 1.3 billion people population and the competition, I mean, we talk in this country about, you know, it's a dog eat dog world and how tough that is. I had a Chinese guy sit me down one day, and he's a good friend, you know, good guy. But he told me, he goes, Mike, you don't understand what it's like over here. You have a dog-eat-dog world in the USA, but here we have a man-eat-man world. That's how bad it is.
Mm-hmm. The Chinese execute thousands of their own people every year. I mean, here we execute, what, maybe a couple of dozen of the worst criminals every year, and the anti-death penalty people scream and yell outside the prison, blah, blah, blah. China just slaughters all kinds of criminals over there, everything from embezzling to white-collar crime to street crime, murder and rape, etc. They have a very simple solution. They just line them up by the hundred in the sports stadium and put a bullet in their head, and it doesn't seem to prevent anything. Yeah, the Asian people, they can be smart, they can be ethical, which is not the same as being moral, but they have no creativity. China reached a certain level of civilization many thousands of years ago, and there they stayed for many, many centuries. The Asian is capable of imitating Western culture, imitating Western technology, but never actually creating it.
Okay, so you hear music. It's our time for our first break. We'll be right back in about 4.5 minutes. So stick with us, folks. Be right back. More with Harold Covington. Stick with us.
And here is the opening theme from one of the top 5 best movies ever made. Every white nationalist should automatically recognize this theme song, and if you don't, if you've never seen this movie, then shame on you. We'll be right back.
Secretary of State for War has today received the following dispatch from Lord Chelmsford, Commander-in-Chief of Her Majesty's Forces in Natal Colony, South Africa. I regret to report a very disastrous engagement which took place on the morning of the 22nd January between the armies of the Zulu King, Cetshwayo, and our own No. 3 Column, consisting of 5 companies of the 1st Battalion, 24th Regiment of Foot, and 1 company of the 2nd Battalion, a total of nearly 1,500 men, officers, and other ranks. The Zulus, in overwhelming numbers, launched a highly disciplined attack on the slopes of the mountain of Isandlwana, and in spite of gallant resistance, the column was completely annihilated.
Got a letter from a guy named Gus in Texas. Dear HAC, comrade, you are doing so much excellently and with such unflagging dedication that I hesitate to criticize you even constructively. Clearly, you suffer far too many armchair quarterbacks as it is. Please rest assured that the following springs from a sincere desire that you healthfully survive the coming months and years outside of a place like Victorville. If anyone deserves to see absolute evidence of the formation of the Northwest Republic, it's you. I've gotten the disturbing impression ever since your Brandenburg lectures in 2011, and now with your Who Guards the Guardians series, that you have opted for martyrdom as a surefire way to awaken anger and vivify our somnambulistic white brethren, rather than continuing to reason, cajole, plead with guilt, and or bellow at them. Well, I fervently disagree with the martyrdom idea, given that you are the only foghorn sounding in their bemisted minds. Your solid nature and reliable leadership in the Northwest is the only beacon that we can see and on which we can set our course. You have for a long time been, and hopefully will continue to be, a lighthouse showing the safest and surest passage through Zogian darkness into the light and freedom of the last white republic. Okay, I admit I don't wax poetic very well anymore, but you get the picture. The Northwest Imperative is the only doable plan, and you are the only man with the intelligence, skill, and commitment to herald the great news that we don't have to become extinct. Okay, look, I won't read any more of this. I'm sure you get the idea. Now, what Gus is worried about is that I have developed some kind of suicidal martyr complex and that I'm deliberately poking at the FBI with a stick until they get mad enough to fabricate some audio tapes of me hiring a hitman and come and destroy me. With the recordings they have of my voice from the past 240 Radio Free Northwests, they could probably fabricate an entire conspiracy between me and Iran to make myself Grand Caliph of Spokane or whatever. And that's only partly humorous. At one point, several years ago, the United States Attorney was threatening to charge Bill White with being a spy for Iran and send him to Guantanamo if he didn't plead guilty to whatever imbecile offense he was being tried for at the time. I deeply appreciate Gus's concern for me, and some others among you have said pretty much the same thing to me, so let's go over this one again. First off, as far as me baiting and poking at the dictatorship, it's my job. It's what you guys pay me the big bucks for. Seriously, at my age and with my track record, I am permanently unemployable. I will never work at any kind of official on-paper job again. Now, you guys are the only reason that I'm not sitting under a bridge or in a Salvation Army mission right now. You deserve some bang for your buck. Secondly, I'm 60 years old now. Those are 60 years that the FBI and the political gangsters and the black robes can never take away from me. For better or worse, mostly worse, I have already lived them. This evil, long ago, took my family from me and destroyed any chance I might ever have had for any kind of personal achievement or happiness. Now, I have no right to complain. I chose this life and I walked into it with my eyes open. I had repeated opportunities when I was young to burn the pinch of incense, to bend the knee and conform so that when I was in my 60s, I would reap the benefits of that conformity. Those opportunities included, among other things, an appointment to West Point, which I turned down because I could not morally fight and kill for this corrupt and wicked society, and a career in journalism and media, which I was offered on the pretty much openly acknowledged condition that I remain forever silent about my true beliefs and pretend to be one of them. I turned that down, too. As young as I was, I understood full well what my rejection meant for my future. I wasn't just turning down an immediate career. I understood that every opportunity to conform, which I rejected, meant that I would never live in a house or drive a car that wasn't a piece of rolling junk, and when I got old, I would be without medical insurance or any kind of safety net. I can honestly say that the only thing I'm afraid of right now in all this mess is the prospect of growing old in the living hell that Obama's America has become. But in that, I'm not alone. I have millions of white people for company. And in any case, it's not like I have any choice, so I might as well go down fighting, or at least talking. Look, Gus, guys, somebody's got to do this. There are only a handful of us left who seem to have the will to fight on anymore. I know some of the others, and they're not bad guys, very sincere, but like Colin Jordan once said, our movement has a very big heart and a very small head. These are the guys who are floundering around on the internet, some of them flat out imitating me, lacking the one thing that might work. A doable plan to create a separate sovereign nation as a homeland for all our people the world over. We have that chance. We have that plan. Like it or not, I am where I am. I have a duty station and I have to man it, and until such time as I can persuade you and others to step forward, I seem to be pretty much the sole custodian of that plan, although I do have some comrades now who show signs of promise. Now, you guys are concerned for my safety? Then step forward and shoulder some of the burden yourselves. The wider the load is spread off my shoulders, the safer I am. Now, because of you guys helping me, I am one of the few white spokesmen out here who is financially bulletproof, at least to a certain extent, and thereby immune to what the liberals call economic discipline. Now, that means that I am morally obligated to be the one who takes the chances, because there's no one else to do it. Some of you who saw the movie Zulu that I just referred to may remember the line where the young redcoat asks the color sergeant, "Why us?" And the color sergeant replies, "Because there's nobody else here, lad. Just us, nobody else." Yes, I know the risks I'm taking, Gus. I am provoking a senile, vicious monster who still has enough power to crush me with one blow of its rotting, scaly tail. I know that, but it's got to be done, and tag, I'm it. But for now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.
Last night I was sitting on a curb. I didn't know what about, but I was feeling quite disturbed. A street sweeper came whistling by. He was bouncing every step. It seemed strange how good he felt, so I asked him while he swept. He said, "It's my job to be cleaning up this mess, and that's enough reason to go for me. It's my job to be better than the rest, and that makes a day for me. I got an uncle who owns a bank. He's a self-made millionaire. He never had anyone to love, never had no one to care. He always seemed kind of sad to me, and I asked him why that was. And he told me it's because in my contract there's this clause that says it's my job to be worried after death, and that's the thing people respect in me. It's my job, but without it I'd be less than what I expect. Most all my life writing songs and sleeping late, and any manual labor I've done was purely by mistake. If street sweepers can smile, then I've got no right to feel upset. But sometimes I still forget. Till the lights go on and the stage is set and the song gets home and you feel that sweat.